Good morning. My name is Justin, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Naples Trust Company quarterly investment conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star, then zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. Thank you. Naples Trust Company, you may begin your conference.
As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with your qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed during this call. Now I will pass this to our hosts.
Good afternoon. My name is Ian Bruch, Portfolio Manager of the Naples Trust Company. With me today is my colleague, Timothy Vick, Senior PM here in Naples as well. On behalf of the entire staff of the Trust Company, thank you for participating in our quarterly conference call for clients and guests. The format today will begin with Tim making a few remarks to summarize the past quarter, along with some comments on the recent volatility we've seen in the first few weeks of the year, followed by the two of us answering questions, which many of you thoughtfully provided over the past few weeks. We will answer as many questions as possible within the time allotted and plan to contact directly those of you whose questions we could not address during today's call. Out of respect for your time, our call will span 30 minutes and end promptly at 4:30. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Tim.
Thank you, Ian. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks very much for joining us. Already it seems that each time Ian and I conduct these calls, we're having to answer for a lot of stock volatility, and each time it seems we've got to answer for the popularity of Donald Trump, too. And right now I don't know which is harder to explain, but I've hedged my bets, and I'm going to ask Ian to take all the questions about Trump. We've gone through a lot since January 1st. As of today, the market was down 7% for the year. The average stock had fallen about 18% from its high, and about half of the U.S. stock market was in a technical bear market. And in fact, several major stock indices around the world had fallen more than about 20% from their 2015 highs as of last week. But we have to emphasize that the losses are still on paper. If you have no intention of selling at these lower prices, and we certainly don't, the price fluctuations aren't as meaningful as they are to someone who must sell right now. And you always got to put this in perspective. Few people would ever list their home for sale just because they read in the paper that house prices might fall next year. And in the same vein, a business owner usually wouldn't be tempted to put her company out for bid just because the economy may slow down or because the Federal Reserve may raise rates in March. But folks do it with their stocks all the time. Why do they do it? I think it's pretty simple, because they can. It's become far too easy to buy and sell a dozen stocks or 100 stocks with just a keystroke anymore. And it has become too easy to let television commentary induce you to sell. Now, we've noticed that the media is asking a lot of questions right now, and rightfully so. You know, can China's slowdown really cripple the world's economy? Is there another banking crisis on the horizon? Is there going to be another interest rate hike? And if so, what are going to be the effects? Can the oil industry's distress spill over into other industries? These are legitimate questions, and we'll talk on these subjects in a few minutes. But with stock prices falling faster than the economic data has been falling, we think the most vital questions to ask are, one, what do the market and the media really know? And two, do the facts support what the market and the media are saying? We tend to frame issues this way because we've learned never to take a market decline at face value. Experience tells us that a 20% decline in stock prices rarely, and I mean rarely, means that businesses have permanently declined 20% in their appraised values. More to the point, it usually means that some investors started believing that business values might fall 20% in the future, and thousands of others just follow them out the door. I'd like to point out that this is the 42nd time that the S&P 500 has corrected more than 10% since the index was created, and those 42 corrections, believe it or not, correctly predicted only 11 recessions. And, by the way, the market went back to its high after all 42 corrections. So with this correction, as with all the past corrections, I think it's vital to assess, first, what is causing stock prices to fall, and second, if those causes will be long-lasting. And that's what we're devoting our time to these days. Now, in contrast, the media has been bombarding us lately with a lot of noisemakers. They're all coming out of the woodwork peddling financial apocalypse. And we find it funny that none of these noisemakers were predicting doom and gloom a year ago, nor did anybody wish to quote them. Instead, they're getting their airtime only after stock prices have fallen 20%, and only then do they go out on a limb and predict another 20% decline. The folks who are now predicting $20 oil were the same ones who were predicting $150 oil 2 years ago. Always keep that in mind. The folks who were predicting a major recession in the United States were generally predicting an accelerating economy a year ago. And the folks predicting another financial meltdown, well, they've been doing that for about 20 years now, and they've got it right only once. I can tell you as a former newspaper reporter from Chicago that you end up getting what you pay for in this business, especially when it comes to media commentary. And everything dished out to you on television or on websites comes free. Remember that. It just comes free. Journalism is the first rough draft of history, and that's kind of an elegant way of saying that the first interpretation of events is always fraught with the most biases and the most errors. Television networks and investing websites are all about filling space now and about generating the highest possible ratings and eyeballs right now. Nothing else really matters to their business models. Nothing else. Accuracy is never their priority. Their role, frankly, is to turn a small problem into a big one. And Wall Street will always oblige. Its goal is to exploit any opportunity to convince investors to change their portfolios. And I think that's what's happening right now. I'd like to stress that in times like this, we invest based on probable outcomes. Probable outcomes. Not possible outcomes. Anything's possible. The Saudi royal family can be overthrown tomorrow. A Chinese bank could collapse. An earthquake could hit California. And sovereign entities like Russia and Puerto Rico can default on their debt. These are all possible, of course. But you'll do your portfolios no good if you're constantly living in fear of and trying to protect yourself from low probability events, especially if these events would have no direct impact on the investments you hold. And sometimes you just have to think it through. I mean, why should a crash in oil prices cause a drug stock to fall 25%? It makes no sense. We see no reason, based on the recent data, to alter our outlook or our time horizon. Many, many companies are still growing and posting record results despite the economic data. And that means their shares are getting more valuable, and that means that clients who choose to hold the shares should eventually enjoy a pleasing return. Our job right now, frankly, is to find these companies and stick with them. So that said, let's address the questions our listeners have sent in. Ian and I will address as many as possible in the time allotted and give you our investment team's latest assessment. And thanks once again for joining us. Ian, take it away.
Thanks, Tim. I'll go ahead and answer. I'll take a shot at our first question, which is, it looks like 2015 ended the year flat. What do you expect this year? I think, you know, let's first discuss where we are currently in the market. I think we entered 2015 saying to our clients that we were pretty fairly valued, meaning just the broader PE multiple on the market was in fair value arena, maybe markedly or slightly overvalued, slightly undervalued, depending on the day. And I think we're sort of ended the year right in that same area. So as we enter into 2016, as we look at earnings growth is projected on the S&P, just as an example, again, broader market metric, up 6-7% this year. If that comes through, I think it's reasonable to assume that prices should appreciate at about that same pace, given that markets are fairly valued or close to fairly valued. However, what happened in 2015, if you'll recall, energy prices sank pretty tremendously, and really a lot of the energy companies got beat up pretty bad, and that basically brought the S&P earnings down to about flat last year. Well, we ended the market basically flat. So if last year is any indication of what holds for this year, I think if earnings growth comes through at 6-7%, right now we have no reason to believe that can happen, then that would be our expectation, I think, for 2016. Our next question is in regards to China, and I'll go ahead and handle this one as well, Tim. How much does China's economy affect my portfolio? Well, I'd say directly not much. We don't have any overt Chinese exposure with any of our companies. They're not domiciled in China. And any direct exposure that we did have, we exited midway through last year when we sold our emerging markets position, specifically for our growth-oriented clients. We saw some of the currency swings occurring, and this was back in August when China came out with some pretty rough numbers and was scaring everyone by devaluing their currency. We took the position out at that point. So directly, we don't have much exposure. Indirectly, certainly there's some. Given the global nature of economies now, it's hard to find a multinational business that doesn't have revenue streams into China. So even the boring stodgy companies like Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble that are bellwethers, they sell into China. Apple is another one that comes to mind. So the Chinese economy does matter at a global level. But if you focus on companies that have reasonable dividends, that are growing their dividends, that's how you protect value long term. So it's something we keep an eye on, but we don't let Chinese news dictate what we do with portfolios. That's for sure. Tim, I'll ask this one to you. How close are we to a recession?
Oh, that's a good one. I'm assuming we're talking about the U.S. going into recession. And I think that gets to the heart of a lot of investors' concerns because that's been the news headline of the month here. Recessions don't just happen. I mean, I've been looking at economic history for a long time, and I know our recessions going back into the 1830s usually had one or two very important proximate causes. One was you had excess production in several key industries, and the second was you had a banking system that started contracting credit. Well, if you look at what's happening in the United States, neither of those situations are occurring right now. We have very little excess production, except in industries like mining and oil and gas. And for the most part, most of our industries are not running at full capacity, or not even close. So there's a lot of slack there. There's slack in the labor markets. So generally, we don't have situations of overproduction where an industry is curtailing itself and thus putting us into recession. The second issue is more important, and that is our banking system. It is probably as healthy as I've seen it, and I've been looking at their balance sheets for about 25 years. They are not contracting credit. By contrast, our banks have been expanding credit at about 8% annual rates, which is a very strong rate, which would tell us that that's stimulus being put and being applied to our economy. So you have our banks adding stimulus through making more loans. You have our federal government now running $400 to $500 billion annual deficits, that's stimulus too. And you have the Federal Reserve that until lately was adding more and more stimulus to the economy. So those are very healthy signs, and it's showing up in the data, which indicates that we still have staying power with our economy. Our labor markets are strong. The consumer spending is rising. Housing is steadily improving. We are actually still building fewer houses than are needed. We have a shortage of houses still. So that industry has a lot of legs to it. Auto sales are coming off a near-record year, and interest rates are incredibly low, which is a boon for consumers as well as businesses. And then we have the issue of low oil prices. As much as we might think that that is a major negative to our economy, it's actually a net positive. It reduces the value of imports, which helps our GDP number and the way it's calculated, but it's also meaning lower input costs for consumers and industrial businesses that use energy. So all in all, our economy looks in pretty good shape. The odds of a recession right now have been pegged by economists at about 20 to 25% this year. We would probably go along with that kind of consensus.
Great. Thanks, Tim. Now, you mentioned banks. This is a question about banks. Many have reported their fourth quarter earnings. Any specific insights?
Well, all the major banks that have reported so far, J.P. Morgan, Wells, Bank America, Citigroup, they all have unique business models with a lot of moving parts. So their financial results have not been fully in sync with one another. But the general trend is very healthy from what we're seeing. And the biggest trend I'm noticing and liking is that they're lending again. As I mentioned, they've been throwing about 8% more loans into the system than they were a year ago. This is what banks need to do. When they lend, their profits grow and the economy grows. It's that simple. What I like about the banks so far is that their loan loss ratios are extremely low. They're as low as we've seen them in well more than a decade. And despite the fact that they have a little bit of oil exposure and their oil losses are going to be picking up here in the next several quarters, it's nowhere near the oil exposure they had in the 80s or even 10 years ago. So it's not even a blip on anybody's radar that oil is going to cause a major problem there. They're increasing their loans, as I said, at mid to high single rates. Their profit margins on their loans have bottomed and are likely going to be rising should interest rates start picking up. They have an incredibly low cost of funds right now. If you're a bank like Wells Fargo, you've brought in $1 trillion worth of deposits the last several years, and you're only paying 9 basis points to depositors on that money. This is nearly free money for a company to lend out and make a nice spread on. And then the banks have gotten all their legal problems behind them. All the settlements are behind them with the government from their misactivities, let's say, from 2008, 2009. So on that front, the banks are looking pretty positive. On the negative side is they still have returns on equity that are much lower than historical, and it's going to stay that way. They're overregulated now, or they're subjecting themselves to a lot more regulation than they did in the past. They have to hold a lot more treasuries, a lot more cash, a lot more securities that just generally don't add to the improvement in book value. So it's going to be really hard for some of these banks to improve their book value and grow that more than 4 to 5% a year. And that limits the appreciation you can get on these securities. So for that reason, we look at a stock like Wells Fargo, which we think is the industry leader, and it's where we want to be for growth and income portfolios. Wells, I think, can still give us a good return. The stock is down about 18-19% from its high. Other banks right now just don't give us the ROE that can tell us they can cover their cost of capital. So we've been preferring instead spread lenders in the credit card business like Visa and MasterCard.
All right, great. Along that vein of technology companies, do we ever invest in tech companies such as, let's list them off here, Facebook, Twitter, Netflix, or Amazon? What do you think?
Well, we've looked at them before. We've looked at Amazon quite a bit over the last 3 or 4 years. We still can't get our arms around the valuation. I mean, the market's valuing the stock right now at about $280 billion. You get a $600 share price. They're barely earning a profit right now, and there's a lot of hope that the next few years their profits are going to soar. The same thing with Facebook, Twitter, and Netflix. They both, all three of them have just outstanding valuation levels. When I say outstanding, I mean very egregious. Facebook's valued at about 100 times its earnings. It, too, is valued at about $280 billion. And the market is valuing Facebook as being worth more than Walt Disney or Exxon or Google or Johnson & Johnson, J.P. Morgan, if you can believe that. And it's a company that still is only making a couple billion in profit. We've always been on the conservative side when it comes to technology. We don't feel we have to chase what is sexy and what is hot right now and what is overvalued. And instead, in our growth portfolios, we've been working the e-commerce and the internet sector in much more conservative fashion by emphasizing the companies that are involved in transactions and not so much selling products, but basically finding ways to make money off every transaction that's occurring to buy those products. So in growth portfolios right now, we have 8 companies that we think are very well positioned into the internet and e-commerce. One would be Priceline, which is, of course, a travel and reservation service. We got PayPal, which is we think is going to be one of the leaders in mobile payments. We also own Google, Visa, and MasterCard. All these companies are growing at very healthy 15 to 16% rates right now, and we think those are real rates that can be sustained, unlike the rates that are presumed in companies like Facebook. We also have in the IT space a few companies, Cognizant Technologies, Accenture, which is the management and IT consulting conglomerate. And then we have Checkpoint Systems, which is a leader in data security and firewalls for large corporations around the world. We think we got a healthy exposure, and therefore we can kind of sit back and watch the Facebooks, fluctuate on their own.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think, most of the names that you just mentioned, one, they're in our growth portfolio, so they're probably not found in all client accounts. But moreover, the multiples you were mentioning on Facebook, 100 times earnings, Netflix, I think, is in the 300s, and Amazon's in the 800s, just in terms of valuation levels. And then Twitter, I don't even think they have a PE because they don't earn any positive net income. You compare that to our average, growth, our growth strategy and the PE multiple found there, it's in the 20 times range. So you're getting a much better deal, and we obviously care about valuation that protects you on the downside. So that's always been a part of our philosophy. It's important. Our next question is in regards to oil prices. I can handle this one. Oil prices continue to fall. What will cause this to stop or move upward? Well, it's clearly been a bit of a supply and demand imbalance. The news has all been on the supply side, and it's justified. Saudi Arabia continues to pump despite its OPEC partners being upset about that. They don't seem to care. Saudi Arabia is the lowest marginal cost producer in the world, so they're going to be the last to turn things off, and they're trying to squeeze everyone else in the process. And it makes economic sense for them to do that. But they can't do it forever because they're losing lots of money. So the supply side will shake out over time, and it's anyone's best guess as to when that will happen. We've seen a ton of production come off domestically as the higher marginal cost producers pull equipment off the ground. And that's happening globally right now, not just here in the U.S., but Brazil, that's happening. So anywhere where it's more expensive to pull commodities out of the ground, they're shutting it down. So the supply side, I think, will take care of itself. And the demand side, we have to remember, there's not a huge disparity between supply and demand, given, in other words, for us to get back to equilibrium, it wouldn't take a significant increase in demand. So if China numbers come through reasonably okay, if U.S. GDP continues in line with where it's continued, we will get a bounce back. The big question is just when. We could be looking at lower oil prices for a good portion through 2016, but at some point they have to move a bit higher. So I think it'll just take some time. I mean, as we get news on the demand side, and if we get any positive news on the supply side, I think you could get a pretty sharp and dramatic reversal to the upside. It's just when. The next question is stock specific. It touches on Apple. Apple has traded lower lately. Is it over or undervalued from your perspective? I'm going to preface my comments with saying that I think Apple is reporting as we speak. So that's going on right now. But in general terms, Apple's been trading right around the $100 mark. That's about a 9% free cash flow yield on the stock, which is about as good a deal as you've gotten on Apple in quite some time. This obviously is a cash machine. And so from a valuation perspective, it does not look overvalued to us. I think a lot of people have been waiting for the Apple story to kind of become old. It's been a darling for investors for a number of years, and I think people are waiting for it to not be that anymore. But they're going to be coming out with their iPhone 7 this year, and we know what that does for sales. And until people stop choosing the iPhone over every other phone, I think Apple's a solid company. And again, they don't have to produce ridiculous growth to justify their valuation, because they're arguably pretty cheap where it stands now.
You can almost add that Apple is priced for almost zero growth.
Yeah,
you know, with a 10% free cash flow yield.
And it, you know, there's also the China story, which is, you know, if you operate under the assumption that China isn't going to completely implode, they have a huge emerging middle class over the next 5 to 10 years, and Apple has really yet to tap that market. So there is a growth story with Apple, particularly outside the U.S. Our next question, let's touch on oil again. Is lower oil a benefit or a drag on our economy? I thought it was supposed to boost our stock market, but lately it has caused it to move lower. Well, I'd say yes. On a net basis, lower oil is a boost to our overall economy, though I think we should say it's less so than it was perhaps in the 80s when we last saw oil go down dramatically. That was a significant increase to our economy because we weren't such large producers. So now a big part of our economy is the production of oil. So on a net basis, it's still a benefit. I'd say it's probably less of a benefit today than it was many years ago. Right now, markets are sort of trading in tandem with oil markets, which is a bit unusual, but that will sort of decouple as time goes on. So if oil is down 2%, you'll notice the market's down 2% these days. That's not going to continue forever. So yes, lower oil, I think, will show up. Particularly, you'll see it in the consumer businesses first, probably the discretionary businesses. You'll see some of that. Some of the costs, it happens at the margin. We understand that people don't change their budgets completely based on lower gas, but people do go out to eat once or twice more when they're spending less on gas, and that shows up in the numbers. But it's always a lagging effect, so we may see some of that benefit come to fruition this year. Our next question, does it seem likely that we will get further rate increases this year given what has occurred in the first few weeks of the year? What do you think, Tim?
I don't know if we can add much value to this discussion, because that has probably been the hottest topic on CNBC and Bloomberg for the last several months. And if you were to tally up the 500 or so people who have been on and ask the same question about interest rates on those shows, you probably get half of them saying, yes, they'll go up, and half of them saying, no, they'll go down. So there really isn't any consensus. And, you know, we look at it from the point of view that the Federal Reserve trapped themselves into having to make rate increases. They certainly would like to move off a zero rate because they need ammunition the next time our economy may get sluggish in the future. But given what's happened with credit markets and what's happened with, you know, overseas, it's probably right for them to take a pause for several months. And in fact, to assume that they're going to raise rates four times this year, like some folks have been assuming this year, I think just contradicts reality. It absolutely contradicts reality. And so the bigger question to us is, even if they do raise, you know, so what? And that's the way investors should look at it. It's only a 25 basis point move. And I think too much emphasis has been placed on the actual rate increase and the actual event itself, and too little on the actual impact, which to us is going to be very negligible. A lot of the companies we invest in are either debt-free or have locked in a lot of low-cost fixed-rate debt long-term. A rate hike's not going to impact them. I don't think a 25 basis point increase is going to impact consumer spending or spending on autos or housing. Perhaps a coordinated series of rate increases over a period of a couple years may ultimately impact economic behavior. But right now, it doesn't look like that's going to be the case. So we're not fearing a 25 basis point extra increase in rates, but we just don't think it's coming.
Great. And I think we have time for one more. Tim, GE reported earnings. How do they look?
Well, GE's been kind of an interesting animal for us. It's in a lot of portfolios as a growth and income stock, where we like it for its modest appreciation potential with growth of earnings plus a nice dividend that we think is going to increase sharply over the next several years. GE's in the midst of a big transition right now, and it's going to have a lot of noise within its next two or three quarters earnings statements, which is going to really distort the picture of what's really going on. They've shed most of their GE capital assets and will finish that this year. So you're losing about $8 billion a year in net income from that division, so their earnings are going to be down. They spun off Synchrony Financial. They've just completed the purchase of French company Alstom, which is adding $8 billion of revenues, but they're losing money right now, so they're going to be taking some charges there. And they've made a huge investment in global infrastructure, oil and gas, railroads, transportation. This is Jeff Immelt's play to really make this a pure industrial company and to boost the P.E. ratio and boost the profit margins. It's going to be a success longer term for us. And I think the market is sensing that GE is actually going to be a profitable play for investors. I mean, the stock was up something like 24% last year, and it made a nice addition to a lot of our growth and income portfolios, you know, to compensate for a flat market. So the market's already starting to reward GE for making this transition. The next couple quarters, it's going to be anybody's bet what the numbers are going to be because of all these transitions they're making internally. But longer term, we really like it.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Tim. And thank you again to all our guests for making the time to join us today. This concludes the Naples Trust Company's quarterly investment call. We hope you found this format to be informative and useful. If today's discussion has generated thoughts or questions, we welcome your call to address them directly. Please contact us at the Naples Trust Company at 239-774-4000. Thank you again for joining us, and have a nice evening.
This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.